Hello, hi everybody, and welcome to Building a Roadmap for Healthy Touring. So we're going to discuss what makes touring stressful today and a few things that you can do to alleviate it. So our hashtag today is hashtag healthy touring. Before we get started, I'm delighted to introduce you to our dream team today. So we're going to start with Ryan.
Hello.
Oh, I'm introducing myself.
Yeah.
I'm Ryan Dusick. Nice to meet you all. I was the founding drummer of Maroon 5, and I'm now a therapist, so quite a life change from that to this. I was in the band from 1994 all the way up to 2006, so made the album Songs About Jane, toured on that for 4 years. Lived a whole lifetime in that time. And then when I left the band, I dealt with anxiety, depression, alcoholism, a lot of issues that I struggled with losing that identity and that career. And entering recovery from that time in my life is what kind of gave my life new purpose and new meaning and sent me back to school to become a therapist and a mental health advocate. And I get to talk to people like you. So thank you.
Amazing. Thank you, Ryan. And Dr. Arun Castro, you
go next? So I'm Arun. I'm from London, England. I'm an emergency medicine doctor by background. About 7 years ago, I burnt out. And so I decided to leave hospital medicine and sort of join the circus and ended up doing festival medicine. So in the last 6 years, I've done about 17 festivals, just freelancing for anyone who needs a doctor. So Glastonbury, Reading, Download, you know, all sorts of events, all kinds of crises. And so whether it's physical health or mental health issues, it really gave me a kind of, you know, a look in at the situation where there's a lack of continuity of care, or there's lack of care, full stop sometimes. And it just got me into this thing. So since then, I've been working a day a week for something called BAPAM, which is British Association of Performing Arts Medicine. It's kind of like PAMA. And we run a clinic which is free for musicians. We get them funding. If they're having a vocal health issue, we can get them an ENT surgeon to have a look at the vocal cords. If they need physiotherapy, we can get all that done. So it's an amazing service, and it's thanks to some big bands that put money towards other charities that we can do that. So now I've set up my own private sort of performing arts clinic for production and also for artists as well. And that's me, the Roadie Medic.
Amazing, thank you. And the legendary Dr. Susan D. Raven.
Oh my God. It's like, don't ever go on before children or animals. With that, anyway, hi everyone. I'm Susan, a clinical psychologist in Oakland, California. And my claim to fame here is that I basically have been writing about musician mental health since the 80s. And, you know, actually, this is wild to almost be back at South by Southwest because I did panels for 10 years from 1994 to 2004. Too bad I didn't meet Ryan then. With Mark Rubin from the Bad Livers, and you know, I love going to Austin every year. But anyway, so I've been writing about musician mental health, published a bunch of stuff on that as kind of my hobby, which is all up on academia.edu for free now. And I've been a longtime member of the Performing Arts Medical Association. I'm an editorial board of their journal. But really, I think my main reason for being here is that, of course, like all of us, I'm a huge music lover. Very rare that I still go see new bands at my age. But anyway, I also was raised by jazz musician parents. My dad had a kind of avant-garde big band, and my mom was the singer for, and they recorded 6 records for Savoy. By the time I was on the planet, the big bands had died like dinosaurs, and so we basically got to see our parents try to survive the music industry, and they didn't do well. They both died pretty young. So I got into this, wrote a dissertation, because, you know, so many artists of my generation had passed away, and some of them I love more than others. But when Tim Buckley died, you know, I really was a big Tim Buckley fan, and then Jeff Buckley. And when Tim Buckley died, I kind of was about to figure out what to write a PhD dissertation on. So I wrote this study of occupational stress and coping in professional rock musicians, not knowing that a now good friend of mine, Jeff Wills in Manchester, England, was doing essentially the same, but a bigger version of the study I did. So Jeff and I had been writing about this, feeling like the lone surfers, like no one was caring, you know. So anyway, really happy to be here today, even though Zoom, and you know, I am an amateur guitarist and singer, but most people never hear that from me. So anyway,
maybe next time.
Everybody. Wish you could see everyone.
Yes, thank you, Susan. And I am Tamsin Embleton. So I'm a psychotherapist that works with musicians, and I run a group called Music Industry Therapist Collective, MITC. We're based across the States and the UK, and we're kind of dipping into Europe now. Everyone here is a member of MITC, and our whole thing is that all of us have worked in the music industry prior to retraining. And we offer individual and group therapy, health assessments, and workshops with people like Warners, Atlantic, Cobalt. But before I became a therapist, I was a venue and festival booker, an artist manager. And because I was working day in, day out on shows, I really thought I understood what touring entails. Like many people, and maybe some of you, I had a somewhat romanticized view of touring. I saw the enlivening parts of it, you know, the exhilarating shows, the travel, the camaraderie, the kudos, and the opportunity to bring your records to life in front of your adoring fans. And whilst all of that is true, I hadn't quite grasped how stressful it is. The loneliness, the anxiety, the compounded stress, the separation from the people, places, and practices that usually keep you feeling stable. All that changed when I went on tour in 2010. So I toured with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds side project, Grinderman. I was tour managing Anna Calvi, who's incredible. And suddenly, what I've been seeing and witnessing backstage for many years started to make a bit more sense. So the withdrawal, the irritability, the fatigue, the substance dependencies and high-risk behavior. Here was a group of people enduring prolonged stress exposure whilst being surrounded by quick-fix solutions. As I heard more and more stories of addiction, suicidality, and mental ill health, it seemed to me that for some people, touring can be a recipe for disaster. So I wanted to study it and become a therapist. So I started to research the psychological impact of touring in 2016, and the findings of that became the basis for this book, Touring and Mental Health, available in all good bookshops and some shit ones. So that's got lots of interview material from people like my absolute hero, Charles from Pixies, and Philip from Radiohead, and Nile Rodgers, and various other people. And luckily, we had some budget from Live Nation to bring on board people like Susan and Arun to write on all sorts of different topics. So you can find inside what to do if you're having a panic attack, an overdose, or a psychotic episode.
Page 270.
Amazing. We cover topics like crisis management, early warning signs of eating disorders, addiction, depression and burnout, and loads of health issues. So hearing health, vocal health, sexual health, general health, nutrition, sleep science, meditation, you name it, we've got it. And because touring really impacts your relationships, there's a lot about group dynamics, conflict, why bands fail, and romantic relationships. So moving on to today, if you have any questions, we should have about 10 minutes at the end to cover them. But so that we can all understand touring a little bit better, Ryan, can you fill us in? What's touring like day to day?
So I went on the road in 2002 to promote the album Songs About Jane, and we were on the road for 4 years straight on that one album. The first half of that was on our way up. The second half of that, we were headliners. So kind of two different days in the life. In the first year, well, in 2002 and three, we played over 500 shows in 2 years. So just imagine sort of the travel and logistics involved with that. Over 500 shows is not including all of the promotional stuff we were doing as well. You know, the in-store appearances, the radio station appearances, meet and greets, you know, fan club events, all the stuff that goes along with it. So a day in the life at that time was like some days waking up, driving in our 15-passenger van, waking up in the parking lot of a radio station or a local distribution center, brushing our teeth with a water bottle in our van, and going in with our acoustic instruments and playing for those guys, rallying the troops. A little later, we would have sound check at a club, after which we would have to schmooze with the local reps, have some drinks and hang out. And this was all fun at the time, of course. You're just rolling with the punches and going with it. Put on a rock show, schmooze some more, get back in the van and maybe drive that night or maybe drive in the morning at 6 a.m. An average of 4 to 8 hours driving around the country every day. If we had a day off, which was maybe once every 2 weeks, that was a drive day. So that was a day we had 8 to 12 hours to drive. There were no like days hanging out by the pool at a hotel, that kind of thing. So that's the first 2 years, and then our album blows up internationally. It goes multi-platinum and everything that goes along with that. So now you have the jet set life as well as a tour bus, and that life was like, the sort of the circadian rhythms had flipped, because now we're playing late at night, we're wired until 4 in the morning, maybe going to sleep when the sun comes up in our bus as it rolls out of town, waking up at noon and just basically stumbling into sound check, get lunch, and then it was meet and greets, fan club, you know, the local radio winners, all that stuff, having to be on for hours at a time, and then a lot of downtime, because you're in an arena and you're backstage, like basically in a locker room for hours of your day, where you're just kind of sitting around waiting, and then having to get up and perform for 2 hours at 10 o'clock at night, and then try to come down from that and get some sleep. And then you add jet lag and all that into it. You can imagine the kind of toll it takes, not to mention all the other things you mentioned, like your relationships back home, your relationships on the road. So it took a toll on me, that's fair to say.
I can see why. Yeah, it sounds very intense and like you're always on. But I want to bring Arun in here and help us understand a bit about sleep. So lots of people talk about sleep deprivation on the road and the impact of that. What's going on?
So there's a number of factors there. You've described most of them. But I think when you are working late, you're exposing yourself to lots of bright light, lots of loud sound. You're overstimulating your brain. Then you have a great performance or a terrible performance. And then your brain is, you know, thinking and it's of analyzing everything that's happened. So you don't have, so you're very high, you're very sort of buzzing, and then you're looking to self-soothe and bring yourself back down. So that's where sedatives come into it. So, you know, different prices, different vices, different prices. So so alcohol, benzos, whatever it is, you know, people will try different things and they'll, you know, self-medicate that way. So yeah, that's the kind of, so the touring rhythm, I think if there's one thing to take home today is the touring rhythm's at odds with your internal body clock. The circadian rhythm is basically influenced by sunlight exposure. So when you've got photoreceptors in your eyes, when you get sunlight hitting that sends a signal to the brain. The lack of light sends a different signal, or absence of signal, and then your body is gonna start producing melatonin from the pineal gland. Okay, so melatonin, you can buy it in the shops, it's in the US. It's just a rest and recover hormone. Okay, so Nature did a great paper in 2018, and they looked at all the things that we know about circadian rhythms, what your body should be doing in this sort of day-night variation. And in terms of your immune system, it all happens from 2 a.m. to 8 a.m. roughly. In terms of sort of rest and recover of organs and things like that, there's timing. So if you're denying yourself the usual kind of 8 hours of rest, it's kind of what our parents tell us, right? Go to sleep early. But if we're denying ourselves that, we're getting this physical light exposure, we stay on, we're wired. So it's the body's not really, you know, updated for touring. But we still love touring. So just knowing this, we need to then understand the science and then harness the solutions.
Okay, so one of the bits of research I came across was about cortisol and performance. So we know that when you're playing instruments at home, cortisol reduces, so that's stress relieving. But the moment that there's an audience there, and this is regardless of how practiced you are or how experienced you are, your cortisol levels increase. And another piece of research showed that for some people, or the people that were measured, their cortisol was reaching as high as a skydive, and it wasn't getting back to baseline the next day. So you can see how, you know, the next day you've got another show, then your cortisol is starting to increase, the stress is starting to accumulate, and you're not getting the benefit of rest, really.
So usually cortisol, in that Nature paper, they got a beautiful picture. It's in this book, isn't it? An adaptation of the cycle. But
oh, yeah.
There's a kind of thing around 7 a.m., like sun rises, your adrenal glands kick out cortisol, and then you start to wake up and you carry on with your day. But if you're on a tour bus, you know, and you're traveling from 4 a.m. to whenever, and you're waking up at 11 o'clock, the previous night is giving you a cortisol peak in the evening. So you get that around 2 a.m., and then you're going to have your natural cortisol peak around 7, and then you're going to have to do meet and greets, which will stress you out. You get a small spike. So it's lots of cumulative stress. And each time, and then add into that changing time zones and jet lag. So it just compounds. So you go from acute stressful episodes and then cumulative stress. And that can then have physical health impacts. So if you have tons of cortisol in your system, your blood pressure will go up. You'll feel anxious, on edge. So you can get physical symptoms and psychological ones, which is exactly what you've been kind of describing with your journey there.
And changeable sleep environments as well. I mean, I know some people sleep quite well on tour buses. I definitely don't. Okay, Susan, so you've been researching mental health in the music business since the 80s. Is Ryan alone? Do lots of people suffer? What's the story from research?
Well, two things I want to just point out. A lot of the occupational stressors that people were writing about back with my study and Jeff's, they've continued. We're talking about stuff like, of course, ongoing financial insecurity. And, what I've learned and written about is that depending on where you are in your career, like if you're playing small-town USA bar bands, you're going to have a different stress picture and resources picture than a superstar person, playing all across Europe for years. So it kind of depends on where you're at in your career. But the kind of things that people always talk about, financial stress in the early days, overload or work underload where you don't have a lot of control, like Ryan's talking about, it kind of came how it came. Performance anxiety is very ubiquitous with a lot of artists. Relationship conflicts on the road with the people you're working with or at home, re-entry, all the stuff that we talk a lot about in the book. And then role conflicts between, being on the road, being a musician with family members or whatever other obligations. So those are kind of classics that have never gone away. But the really striking thing that Tamsin and I wanted to get across today was that certainly, people are not alone. If anyone in this room today is talking about their own mental health, anxious, depressed, even suicidal thoughts, you are not alone on this. And back in my day, I remember in like whatever year that was, begging people at South by Southwest and North by Northwest to fill out a paper and pencil questionnaire for me. And I think, I wrote that study up with some people like in the night, whenever it was, it's on academia. But now we've got internet, large internet studies. They're not clinical studies of diagnosable mental health conditions, but they paint a picture that's really disturbing, that things are not getting better, they're getting worse. And I want to say, so I'm going to tell you, there were 5 large internet studies starting in 2016 with Help Musicians UK. And then the most recent one was Ian Newman's crew study of Thrive for tech people and for the workers. And, so we got a sample size with these 5 studies of about 6,600 people. It's a lot of people, right? And so Tamsin and I said, well, let's just talk about the big numbers since we don't have a lot of time in this. In those 5 studies, 34 to 73% of the people self-reported high levels of depression. 67 to 73% reported anxiety. In the Thrive study for crew, 58% of those people reported that they had lost a colleague to suicide. I mean, that's a pretty shocking number. And this is, again, before COVID. And then 26% of the people self-reporting in the crew study said they had their own suicidal ideation. So, this has been a really big issue. And then, the other thing that we kind of always knew in the culture, but then Diana Kinney and Asher did an actuarial study of death rates from like 1950 to, whatever it was, later years, 2014 or whatever it was. And the research that they showed, and it varied by genre. Basically, popular musicians seem to die about 25 years prematurely from the general US population. So here's where we're talking about the need for systemic change in the culture, not just individual resilience, although that really matters, and you'll hear more about that today too and in the book.
Thank you.
Pam, that kind of gets to it.
I think to ignore it is just not ethical, but also from a business standpoint, you're losing talent.
Yeah.
So
and not investing in long-term careers.
Right.
What a waste.
Let's go back to, I want to talk a little bit about how your touring continued and how stress started to impact you. Can you tell us a bit more?
Yeah, well, I think going into touring for me, I was already somebody who was put a lot of pressure on myself. I was a perfectionist by nature. I was somebody who had anxiety, not to a high level yet at that point. I didn't experience like stage fright, but I definitely put a lot of pressure on myself to perform at the highest level. There was constant, I was almost sort of obsessive compulsive about everything that I did. So you take that on the road, and I just kind of took this attitude of I'm just going to lean into this. I'm just going to try to have fun with it. And that worked for a while. You know, go out and have some beers and hang out after the show and turn this into a party. And that worked for about a year and a half. But then the external pressure of what we were doing kind of met up with the internal pressure, because now we're playing on The Tonight Show, and we're playing on Saturday Night Live on live television in front of millions of people. And so you have that level of pressure on a daily basis on top of the amount of pressure I'm putting on myself, and I started breaking down. It started physically. I started having joint pain, which went back to an old pitching injury, but it got worse on the road. And then it was nerve issues. My coordination started suffering. Something that I later realized, actually relatively recently realized, is something called focal dystonia or musician's dystonia, which is basically, it's like my nervous system just told me, you're killing yourself. You can't do this anymore. Athletes call it the yips. You know, sometimes like when you have performance anxiety and a pitcher can't find the plate anymore, or a golfer can't just do a simple thing they've done a million times. That's kind of what it felt like for me as a drummer. Things that I had coordinated for a decade at that point became very difficult. And my body was breaking down. My entire constitution was kind of breaking down. I felt like more and more defeated each day. And it wasn't something that happened in one day or one tour. It was something that happened over a matter of months and years.
And you were doing lots of things to kind of adapt to this problem, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, at first it was, my first thing was try harder, right? So bear down more, you know, focus harder and grab the sticks harder, which of course wasn't helping anything. You're supposed to relax when you're playing music. And then it was, I was adjusting my drum set like higher or lower or far apart or close. you must be a drummer, you must know what I'm talking about. Are you, okay. Well, so it was like all these different things to try to manage it. It was like, maybe I need to have just a shot of whiskey before I go on stage, just to relax a little bit. Maybe, who knows? But it would work for a tour. I changed my mechanics or something like that, and it would help me get through that tour. But that only lasts so long, and then my mechanics were all screwed up.
And you did see quite a lot of different physicians, who gave different advice as well.
Right. So I went to every kind of doctor you can possibly imagine, and they all had different answers for what it was. I went to an orthopedist. He said I had a lot of inflammation in my shoulder and gave me a shot of cortisone, and I played that night in Tampa, Florida. And then I went to a neurologist who said that I had something called thoracic outlet syndrome, which is basically like carpal tunnel of the whole arm, and said, you need some rest and you need physical therapy and you need these pills, you know, that were central nervous system depressants. I went to a psychiatrist who gave me more central nervous system depressants. Before I knew it, I could barely walk, let alone play the drums. So, you know, all these different doctors were not really helpful at the time. I felt like there wasn't really somebody who could see the bigger picture, what was going on for me, in a holistic way.
That sounds really disorientating, not having control over it. And we know that there's problems with kind of rock docs, as you might call them. Especially on tour, you know, you can, maybe a promoter introduces you to a doctor, maybe you get one at the hotel, but nobody's actually overseeing the care, the continuity of care, as we would say.
So it's lots of snapshots happening independently,
right?
So you can get tons of meds and OD, so
right.
Risky.
Absolutely. Can you tell us a little bit about what was happening in Ryan's body as that kind of stress was accumulating?
Yeah, so I suppose probably what was coming through was with alcohol, there's a bit of tolerance. You mentioned you're drinking a lot, and you know, do I need to drink some whiskey to be able to play the drums? So that's often people go for coping strategies like that. But I think the focal dystonia thing, it's quite a rare-ish condition. But if you work in music, you'll find people that have had it. And the same you can have for vocalists as well. And it's just backed up by, so lots of stress. It's a type of conversion disorder, so it's a neuropsychiatric thing. When they you get a head CT scan, there's no tumor, okay, but then you get an MRI, and they've done functional MRI studies, that show that there are changes in pro players when they're going through this condition. And sometimes you can go through therapy. So sometimes they'll tape up random bits of wood or something to change the dynamics, so then you have to relearn. And I think that's what you're trying to do. You're adjusting your set and just intuitively. But that's what people do if you have that problem. And who knows how long it takes to recover. Some don't recover, and some will.
Are there other ways that chronic stress can affect the body?
Yeah, so I suppose, I was talking about that the touring rhythm not being in sync with the circadian rhythm. So lots of cortisol throughout the day. If that accumulates over time, the body's going to retune. So there's a concept called allostasis. So I guess going back to biology class, homeostasis is where a living cell stays alive by processing the toxins and the nutrients and has happy balance. But you know, our lives tell us that this isn't the reality. As we get older, we get fatter, we get heavier, our blood pressure goes up, our exercise tolerance drops, we get breathless, we get more crumbly, we break things, we forget things. that's allostasis.
Okay.
It's basically, I've lost my train there. So acute stressful moments in time have a cumulative effect.
Right. Okay. And we know as well, from a psychological perspective, that sometimes when psychological stress isn't discharged, it can show up in medically unexplained symptoms in the body. You know, we talk about the body remembers or the body keeps the score. And in extreme cases, psychological stress can even result in strokes and heart attacks. You know, this is something, the mind-body connection is very real. So this isn't something that is being made up. It's the body expressing something.
Yeah, if you push your blood pressure high enough over 200 and you have some risk factors, you may have a stroke.
Right.
But equally, other things that people have when under stress, what was I talking about? I can't remember.
Allostatic overload.
Allostatic. So like the body's retuning all the time. My stress is getting to my bandwidth. But
that's all right. Look, we've got to sort of move on a little bit from this one. We've got so much to talk about today. Ryan, were you in a position to say stop or slow down or, you know?
No. No. I mean, there were several times when I was sort of hitting the wall that I would ask management, you know, we have a month off in September. Can we leave those dates open so we can just take a month off? And it was like, no, actually, now we have to go to Japan for a week because the record is coming out there, or now we have to shoot the next video. And so what looked like we were going to have a month off all of a sudden is 3 days off, you know, back at home in L.A. I don't know if that would be different now if times have changed, but then I was in the middle of this, basically this enterprise that was not just our band, it was our management and our record label and our promotional team. And so you have hundreds of people who are all, you know, pitching in to make us, you know, the biggest band in the world. And, you know, I felt bad saying, like, I don't know if I can keep this up. Like, we needed to take a break and I need to recover. But at a certain point, I was saying that and it was like, well, just get through another month, just get through another 6 months, just get through another year, and then you'll have, you know, all the time in the world. But it didn't come for me.
Right. And I mean, there's just a tremendous pressure to kind of carry on going because you're at the center of this huge kind of system. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to talk about autonomy because you didn't have much autonomy there. You know, we need to feel like we're in the driver's seat in our own lives to have good mental health. And when we don't, and on tour we don't, you know, a lot of choice is removed and there's a function to that so you can focus on the show. Ordinary chores are removed. But this has unexpected consequences for your mental health. It can be very frustrating. If we don't have autonomy, we protest. And if those protests aren't heard, then people collapse into numbness or submission. Susan, who's most at risk of suffering on the road?
You know, I would say for starters, people who have pre-existing mental health conditions untreated. And, you know, many of us have been talking about adverse childhood experiences. There's a lot of research now. And the more you have, the more vulnerable you are to medical problems and psychiatric problems and addiction. But the kind of thing that look like an adverse childhood experience is either violence in the home, neglect or intrusion, parent who's, you know, who's died, in prison, all the bad things you would imagine would sound like an adverse childhood experience. So the more people had of those, and there was a study by Ellis, I think it was, around ACEs and musicians, and, you know, showed the same relationship. But anyway, so, you know, I would say, so pre-existing mental health conditions, growing up in poverty, growing up in systemic racism, sexism, you name it, isms, and those are all gonna add risks to somebody. History of mental health in the family, kind of related, stressful experiences like losses, and you know, recent breakup. I've also talked about in the occupational stress literature a concept called person-environment fit, that some systems are just better for some people than, you know, just by nature of introversion or extroversion, whatever it is. So being in the right kind of environment for you is another kind of factor in here. So those are all things that, you know, and the more isolated you get, where you're not talking about any of these things, and like Ryan, you talked about that you kind of didn't know how to think about it until later, you know, the idea of having more experienced people, having the stigma break down where you don't get isolated, you can talk to others honestly without shame, and, you know, find the people who can really help you who are doing better. So anyway, that's one way of thinking about this.
And we don't all respond to stress in the same way. We have different thresholds, you know, that are related to how well-resourced we are, the kind of social systems around, lifestyle practices, outlook, but also temperament. One bit of research I came across, which I love talking about, is by a guy, an American pediatrician called Thomas Boyce. Boyce or Boyd? Not sure. Anyway. So he researches resilience in children. He's been doing it for decades. And he found that 4/5 of children were like dandelions. They could pretty much thrive and survive in any circumstances. But 1/5 of children were much more like orchids. They needed the right environmental conditions in order to grow. And orchids had both the best outcomes and the worst outcomes. So they had a much higher creative potential than dandelions, much higher creative potential. But they also suffered much higher rates of stress-related disorders when exposed to the same amount of stress. So, you know, these people may gravitate towards creativity because it feels good and because they have natural aptitude, but then they'll suffer greatly in high-stress situations like touring. So we're going to move on to talk a bit about solutions. Ryan, knowing what you know now, what would you do differently if you were going back out on the road?
Well, I didn't have, you know, some of the options that obviously I wish I had, but there were things that I could have done to prepare better for the road and the experiences that I would have and to deal with it. You know, I was an introvert by nature, and I need time to myself, which you don't have a lot of, you know, when you're in basically a submarine with a bunch of guys. But, you know, I think that on the road, when you do have time to use, you know, in ways that give you self-care, whether it be to take the sleep when you can get it, which I wasn't always good at. You know, it was like, there's so much stress, you think, I gotta blow off some steam after the show or something. Whereas maybe if I had gone to bed earlier and gotten a good night's rest before we flew the next day for 8 hours or whatever it was that was on the demand of the day, I might have recovered or been able to deal with the stress a little better. In terms of preparation, I think that, I grew up in the 80s and watched the rock stars of that era, like the Guns N' Roses and the Motley Crues, and just thought, you know, being a touring musician is just a big party, and you're basically just having fun the whole time, and you just have to lean into that. I wasn't to that degree by any stretch of the imagination, but I think that was a little bit of a warped mindset in terms of what the demands are. Really, you're a high-level athlete, really, if you're performing every night in that way. And so treating myself in that way probably would have been more conducive to a sustainable lifestyle. So, you know, whether it's rest, whether it's diet, and getting the exercise when you can, and really, I think also just expressing the feelings more. You know, I was a guy in my 20s. A guy in your 20s doesn't always have the kind of emotional maturity, you know, that you might want to have. But I think that if I had an outlet, we couldn't have had a therapist to me on the road, but with the guys, you know, if we maybe had more ability to process the feelings as they were coming up, deal with the stress in a more productive way, maybe that would have helped.
Definitely. Thank you. Arun, is there anything Ryan could have done before he went out on the road to support his body?
Yeah, so, you know, you mentioned being an artist, being a performer, it's like being an athlete. The whole week, the whole day is building up to that, you know, 40-minute set or an hour and a half, whatever it is, and the whole day is about that. So if we look at sports teams, they will have a physician, they'll have strength and conditioning, they'll have nutrition advice. With the amount of money and with the amount of pressure to perform, with the physical nature, they've done studies monitoring heart rates of people in various types of bands, and you know you can get to sort of 75 to 80% of your normal baseline heart rate playing. So it's not, it is physically exerting. It's not just a joke and fun. It is a job, which is the other thing. So thinking about it, if we again, like if we can maintain people, you know, functioning and creative, you know, so let's just get beyond just the bottom of crawling through a tour and causing damage to themselves, but can we optimize them, and who knows what creativity can come with that. So I guess that's my pitch, you know, it's we should steal from sports medicine and apply it to musicians, dancers, actors.
Is there anything that could be done in advance for injury prevention, or is that something that
So there's lots of physiotherapists that will kind of give you exercises specific to your role, specific to you know the instrument you play. So usually strings, it's upper limb issues. Dance is lower limb. So there'll be different common presentations, and there can be some prehab you can do, rather than having to get injured and then do rehab, which takes much longer. It's kind of common sense, but we don't really invest enough in that. And it might not be that the individual artist has to pay. It might be something that you know agents and other people should offer that as part of the terms. You know.
Okay, so something about you know developing routines, I suppose, building that in, warm ups,
yeah,
warm downs.
Yeah, so I think you know in the ideal world, you would have wonderful routines at home. You'd be grounded. You have good friends and family. But a lot of musicians don't always come from those backgrounds. But you know, investing in home. So there's some of the tours they do, is it Family Hour?
So Chris Grattan is one of the people I interviewed for the book. He used to be the tour director for Justin Bieber. And he said Hailey Bieber instigated Family Hour at 4 o'clock every day. And everyone on the tour, no matter what role you're in, downed tools and had to connect with somebody outside off the tour. Which, you know, he was told it wasn't possible to do that, that it would be too disruptive to sound checking, but they did manage, and they kind of insisted everybody leave their station. So there are things you can do, and it's really helpful to do that, to kind of honour the families at home as well, and to show that they're part of things and that they're important.
And it keeps you connected, because it's so easy to, you know, be very isolated on a tour. You're with the same people, you know, you see them day in, day out. You just want your own space, or you want to connect with something that isn't the tour. It's really important, and that boosts your mental health.
And it's hard, isn't it, when you're in different time zones as well. You're not just physically in different places, but psychologically in different places to people at home. Okay, Susan, how could Ryan have supported himself psychologically?
Well, I think, you know, I'm kind of on a rant about the importance of social connection, social support, but it's got to be the right time, right? But hearing the story about Justin Bieber's situation, I remember James Blake came and spoke at PAMA on a suicide prevention panel a few years ago, and he was describing where he really got depressed around food and bad habits and all the hanger-on, all the kind of cliche, almost bad influences that end up with someone who's, you know, a rising star for the wrong reasons with drugs or whatever. And apparently James Blake's girlfriend, who's a beautiful actress, I forget her name right now, basically put her foot down and said, get rid of these people who are hurting you, and kind of got him back on the right path. So yay for partners, you know, you get it. I think, you know, Ryan, when you've talked about being, you know, new to it, I mean, the whole kind of image of the young musician, suddenly your biggest dreams came true and suddenly you're propelled into this new world. You know, it doesn't always happen like that, but that was your experience and certainly a story we've heard a lot. So the idea of not having the emotional maturity or the right kind of support around you is huge. What might have helped? I'm hoping the book, that people start reading this book, and some of the more experienced members of tours, whether they're crew or musicians, start creating this better culture where it is okay to talk about stuff like this and give each other guidance. You know, to have young artists get guided by more mature, experienced people, that would be a good outcome of this whole movement of stuff. But, you know, so basically social support, you know, learning how to mature enough to be able to have compassion for your own needs and be able to voice them and sort of assert yourself. I mean, that's all of us are still learning how to do that better, I think. But learning healthy ways to express yourself and, you know, kind of be your own champion. I mean, I think that's the goal. And people come into that kind of a situation with all different levels of expertise or, you know, ability yet. So having the more experienced, more mature people helping. And that's why it is so important, Ryan, yay for you, for being willing to tell your story without shaming, you know, without feeling stigmatized by it, because for years that didn't happen. You know, even in the PAMA world with classical artists, nobody wanted to say if they got injured because there were, you know, 200 other violinists who would come and get your job at the symphony or something. So, you know, the silence, culture of silence, which Tam talks about in one of the chapters in the book, that's, you know, it's been part of the problem. So that's why it's so important that we're bringing this out to a bigger systems level way of approaching it now. So anyway, that's, I think, the main thing that I would say.
And I think that kind of ties in with the message people can get when they are struggling is you should be really grateful for this opportunity. And it really silences people. And yes, it is a great opportunity, but you know, it comes at quite a cost. And I think we have to be, you know, as Susan says, kind of mature enough to hold both and say, look, people have natural physical and psychological limits. Sometimes tour pushes you past them, and really try and listen and check in if you're part of the team at home. In the UK, there's a big kind of movement, would you say, towards mental health first aiders and sending, having people who are trained on the road to recognise early warning signs and kind of act as a confidant. That's really important. And healthy ways to decompress. You know, you've got all that adrenaline and cortisol after the show and you're kind of fizzing with it and you want to do something with it, and it's really easy to just sink a load of beers, especially if you're surrounded by it. So
page 270 again.
Amazing. This is encyclopedic.
He wrote that chapter. That's
right. It's not mine.
Amazing. But, you know, we can think about, if you're part of the venue team, you can think about offering dry dressing rooms. Actually, I'm getting ahead of myself because we're going to talk about teams. We'll come back to that. So, yeah, talking about building individual resilience will only get you so far. You know, people do have limits. So, Ryan, what could your team have done to support you better?
Well, you know, when we were heading out to promote that record, I remember us, you know, very distinctly having a talk about media training, you know, and the kind of things we need to do to sell more records and to present ourselves and create a brand. But there was no conversation about how to make a sustainable career or lifestyle for us. Of course, that was a different time 20 years ago, but I think that if a record label can afford to invest in media training, they could probably afford at least one, you know, conversation before you go out on the road about here's what you can expect, here's what is going to happen, these are the kind of stresses you're going to be under. I think systemically that would be a starting point. It is nice to see that you know, the industry has changed, there has been a shift. You do see people canceling tours for their mental health and talking about this stuff, you know, on social media and stuff like that. So that is encouraging to see. That was not a dialogue that was happening 20 years ago. So I felt very alone, of course, in what I was going through. I'm like, am I the only person who's going through this? There was that imposter syndrome. It's like, do I belong here? Like, you know, are all these other top-notch musicians experiencing anything like this? So anyway, the more we talk about it, the more people share their stories, the more that people are invested in a more sustainable, manageable type of career for these artists. And not just the artists, you know, the production team, the crew, the sound guys, the riggers, all those people. I think that's really important.
Absolutely. So we know, you know, there's lots of artists more recently who've cited mental ill health and burnout and cancelled shows. And previously, you know, this has been happening throughout sort of the history of touring, but we used euphemisms for it before. We called it exhaustion. So now at least it's being kind of named as what it is, and you know, a testament to those artists for having the courage to kind of to do that. Sue, let's have a think.
I think there is, you know, positive change. Like, I was involved with, there's a band that did a stadia tour, like, on their world tour. They dropped into London, and they said, we want to do something for our crew. So they've done 40 shows in, I don't know how many months. They're in London for a week. We want some physios, we want some acupuncture. We want to just give them something. And, you know, it was really sort of well-received, and they want us back. I think it's things like that. You know, if you're a band in a position where you can do that, it probably doesn't cost you that much. But it's the sort of emotional contagion of a tour. If everyone's having a hard day, it just bounces off everyone else. Yeah. And then it's a hard week and a hard month, and when's the end of the tour? And then it gets extended.
Yeah, and that's psychologically quite difficult because you're trying to get to the hump, you're trying to get to the middle bit of the tour, and then you're trying to get to the end, and then suddenly it's even further away. It's quite disheartening. So, you know, it's not one size fits all. Capacities do vary, and it would be great if people could get into the habit, agents and promoters, people that are routing tours, of consulting with production managers and tour managers about what are the health implications of this routing. Not just, is this logistically possible? Can we get those trucks from A to B? But, you know, what is, what's the health implications?
Like the textbooks would say, if you're travelling eastward 8 hours to a time zone, say, I don't know, Japan or somewhere, from the UK, that it can take you 8 days for your body to adapt to the circadian rhythm, to catch up with where you are and to phase shift.
Right.
By which point you've already moved to a different country. So thinking about the routing and how that's going to impact the well-being of your crew and the alertness, like the number of injuries, working at height, and just things like finger fractures and moving bits of staging around, because you're working at 4 a.m., and you're tired. Just thinking about the routing and factoring jet lag in is important. I could go on about jet lag, but maybe another time.
Go for it.
Yeah, so jet lag is, if you're at that level, you're doing really well, great. But physiologically, it's going to push you. So the things that you can play with are caffeine, and thinking about the timing of caffeine, light exposure, or the opposite of light exposure, to bring in that natural melatonin. You can also take sort of synthetic melatonin prescribed or over-the-counter in the US. You can think about, other holistic things like aromatherapy. If you, back home, you usually have a scented candle of a particular smell. You can use these things to give your brain cues to kind of get you into the mode, like sleep mode, rest, recover, and we go again tomorrow. So that's my little thing.
And stuff like hearing protection, it's such a basic. Luckily, my tinnitus seems to have gone, but it was, while I was working in live music, quite present. And, we know that in times of stress and anxiety that your perception of pain increases, which is I found really interesting, and your perception of tinnitus and stuff as well. So it's all kind of feeding into each other. And nutrition, by the end of the first week when I was on the road, I was so sick of party food. I was like, what? I mean, more crisps. I mean, I quite like crisps, but there was a lot. So, Susan, what are the warning signs people can look out for that might suggest someone's struggling?
Okay, and of course, I often have this conversation in the context of drug addiction or behavioral addictions, whatever. When you start seeing a bandmate or someone you care about on your tour, changing their behavior in some ways that it's a little off and it's not making any sense, they might get... showing up late or not showing up at all for, rehearsals or whatever it is, or they start being in withdrawal or they're pissed off all the time and leaking out. Those are all things. They start acting out sexually. Things that you just see or something's shifting. So that's usually a good time to pay attention and wonder what's up and see if you can help them. By the time someone gets into the, dreaded burnout phase, what goes along with burnout? Being exhausted, being less productive, and then starting to not give a shit. Starting to like fade out and just feel negative and checked out. So those are all, signs psychologically and physically of just being, something's got to give to reset in a more productive way. Now, the good news is, you know, we talked about, you know, in the book about resilience. The good news is because our beautiful little brains are still plastic, you know, we get to learn better habits over time through practice. So, you know, in the same way it takes someone learning to play a musical instrument, maybe frustrating, but you keep at it, you get better at it, right? Three steps forward, even if it's two steps backwards. So the idea of learning resilience skills, and Arun could spend an hour talking about this too, we all could, and it's all in the book, but you know, there are biological things around resilience, there's the emotional compassion, mindfulness, you know, positive awe, which is, as Tamsin knows, is one of my things I've been talking a lot about lately. The idea of, you know, something greater than your ego, something greater than yourself that renews you, might be spiritual, might be other people, but all of those things help build resilience over time, and they really matter. So that's something we all need to keep working and getting better at too. So I'd say,
thank you.
Yeah, like develop the resilience, strengthen it, you know.
Awesome, thank you. Okay, so we are coming to the end. I'm just going to ask everybody, is there one thing you'd like the audience to take away? Arun?
You know. Touring rhythm is opposed to the circadian rhythm.
All right, and Ryan?
Well, first off, I have to get a plug in for my book, Harder to Breathe.
Yes.
Check it out. Have to get that in there.
Which is in the South by Southwest bookshop on the third floor, room 10C, and Ryan's going to be doing a signing tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.
Hope to see
you.
For me, the one takeaway is be kind to yourself. You know, we all have limits to what we can endure. And, I think that when you go out on the road, you have to be mindful of that and treat yourself with kindness. You know, give yourself the rest and rehabilitation you need to be your best, to thrive.
Awesome. And Susan?
I have to steal from a brilliant guy at USC, whose name I'm forgetting right now, where he said, well, you know, the Barbra Streisand effect. And everyone went, what's that? He goes, people who need people. So my takeaway is don't isolate, don't go it alone. Get connected.
Thank you. And mine is build your skills. You know, we can develop resilience, not just individually, but as organizations and as an industry. So that is us for today. If you'd like to ask us some questions, we'll have a bash at answering them.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm very tall, so I'm going to lift this up. My name is McKenna Michaels. I'm a singer-songwriter, and I also am high-functioning autistic. And so I wanted to ask you, a lot of these things you've talked about kind of affect people on the autism spectrum a little bit more than they'd affect a neurotypical who suffers with anxiety or depression, et cetera.
Yeah.
What are some tools and resources that we can do to help autistic people who are trying to tour, and also as the next generation of musicians kind of advocate for changes in touring in the music industry to ensure that people that are neurodivergent have access to similar success as people who aren't?
It's a great question. So one thing that if sensory overload is a problem, then noise cancelling headphones, got you. And some people find it beneficial to have a weighted blanket. There's a few, in fact, in chapter one, we talk a little bit about neurodiversity and touring and kind of really clearly expressing what it is that you need from people, maybe asking if you need things to be repeated. And just there's a bit of support for management and teams as to kind of identifying what the needs are, essentially, and making reasonable adjustments. Would anyone else like to jump in?
I think it's, you know, between management and performer, it's having that clear communication that this is the context I'm coming from. And the other side is to get schooled on what do I need to do to make this work. But I think, you know, times are changing, and I think it's moving forwards. And it's a lot more positive, you know, if you're neurodiverse. Like, personally, I get very overstimulated with loud music, so why would I work a festival? So I'm always carrying around these, you know, in-ear defenders, and I might use them in situations that other people might not use. So it's very different, you know, there's a spectrum. Like, you could be at a really extreme end, you could be kind of borderline on the edge, and we're all different. And it's, again, having that conversation with management or whoever you're working with, your band, your crew, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Aaron, I know you mentioned something about this, and I guess you'll probably hear me. I think one of the biggest things I've ever struggled with just in life, I'm a creative, I perform as well, but looking to do more of that, but spend a lot of time surrounding musicians, and it's always late hours, and when I'm like most productive myself, I'm like waking up earlier. Like, is there a healthy way to just shift your circadian rhythm? And I know that you mentioned something about like, and I know that there is something scientific with like sunlight in the morning, and I know you mentioned a few things, and I think I just missed your last key takeaway there.
Are you trying to work earlier in the morning? Is that your productive time naturally?
I'm just trying to like decide, you know, in my own life, like, can I just embrace the fact that I like go to bed at 4 a.m. and like wake up later?
You can, yeah.
Even I do a lot of video editing, and like,
yeah, and a lot of people.
I'm always fighting between like waking up early and like being productive.
This is it. It's like, it's not like you must not and you cannot. But you might find that you're just tired, or there's a cumulative. So you get this thing called sleep pressure. So if you're not sleeping at the normal times, there's this drive to want to sleep, and that's because of this day-night variation. So light input into the eyes, signaling to pineal gland, and then that's producing melatonin. If you screw with that by having bright lights at 4 a.m. and then lights go off, and then lights come up at 7. There's going to be a cumulative effect.
So some people use 10,000 LUX light boxes to help the body to sort of wake up at different times. So you could find something like that.
Yeah, not product placement. These are my own. Genetically I'm from Sri Lanka, but I live on like the 35th parallel. So we get SAD at home. So, you know, this sort of thing gives you that kind of, it encourages you to produce the cortisol to wake up and stuff at the appropriate time to go to work.
And one piece of advice I got when I was struggling with sleep was, if I can't sleep except rest, you know, that your body's still getting quite a lot from rest as well.
And naps. Naps count as well. That helps.
I wasn't given the gift of being able to nap.
Yeah, same.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. We can talk outside after as well if you can get a bit further.
Hey guys, what's up? Just to give you like a little bit of background, I guess. I'm someone who, I'm in my mid-30s, I'm single. I've worked like blue collar and like production jobs up until now, which, you know, it's kind of a similar thing, burning the candle at both ends, you know? And I took into note what she said about, you know, if you have a lot of past trauma, childhood stuff, you know, that's something that I've kind of resolved in my own life moving into this. And now, you know, I'm being offered to go on tour like in my mid-30s, and coming to this panel honestly just scared the shit out of me. You know, like, I'm like, you know, I don't have resiliency had in my 20s. However, I have like combated a lot of the childhood stuff, and, you know, a lot of my mentors have told me like that's what's going to make you a great artist, you know. So it's, I guess the question I'm asking is like, is that a possible thing? Is it a sustainable thing to go into your 30s on tour, to start out at the small bars and stuff, you know, with a lot of, you know, promising people telling you, like, you've got it if you really want to do it, but, like, do you want to do it? You know, or do you just want to stick to your blue-collar gigs and just, you know, be big in your hometown or whatever? I'm, like, I'm at that crossroads where I'm, like,
I'd say go do it, have a plan and think what strategies you're going to put in place so you don't go off the rails and do the cliche.
Right, and this, and I want to get this book, and you know that's what I'm doing, is just trying to take every precaution I can to like see that I do have a chance. Does that book have some examples of like people who are doing it well? There's some great success stories of people who are living, you know, like this.
Yeah, I'm sorry if this has been a bit doom and gloom.
Like, yeah, it's like,
like, we're not saying touring's bad, but it's about being able to say no as well, and it can be very tempting because you can make quite good money, right, on the road, and it's about having that balance and thinking, all right, I'm coming to the end of this three-month tour, I'm going to take a bit of time off before I take the next one, but there can be a bit of feast and famine. Don't spend all your PDs, don't sort of splurge everything on the tour and come back and be skint and have that sense of, fuck, I've got to take something really quickly.
That was one more thing that I wanted to point out is because I have gone to a lot of therapy and stuff like that, I have developed boundaries and, you know, stuff that I didn't have when I was younger. And like you were saying, because I'm the same way, when the label pushes you, you know, to be like, oh, we can just do a little bit, you know. Was it always yourself, like, not letting you do it? Like, if you had said, like, no, like, I'm taking the time, like, are they respectful with it? And that's kind of more of like a label versus independent kind of route, you know?
I think there is more room now for that kind of conversation, because I think people are more mindful of the long-term effects and wanting to build a career. The one thing I'll say is that our intent was not to say that it's inherently bad or that you should not do it. The point is that it's an inherently unbalanced lifestyle. And so finding balance within that lifestyle is something you need to be mindful of going into it. It's not impossible.
That gives me hope, because I do, you know, I kind of seek that out in production. Like, you're kind of seeking this wild, it's festival, it's tour life, you know, like it's, and I enjoy that. And I've kind of, you know, figured out how to do that in a healthy way. But that, yeah, that gave me what I needed.
Thank you.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Questions for Ryan. Do you still play? And under what circumstances, if at all?
I do still torture myself. I have a little studio on my property that I play in. I haven't performed in a long time, and I play more guitar than I do drums, mostly with my family and my friends just jamming and having fun. I do have fantasies of someday getting back on stage with the guys at a reunion tour or something like that, but as of now, that doesn't seem likely, but we'll see.
Awesome. That's a possible then.
Hi guys, my name is Corey Michaels. My question is regarding more so independent artists. We talked a lot about more industry, you know, big label, kind of big budget things. But when you're an independent artist, for me myself, I went on my first ever kind of bigger tour last summer. And that was an amazing experience, but I feel like it was mostly that dream-like high experience, you know, when you're your first time out on the road and you have 16 dates and you're like, oh my God, I've been dreaming about this since I was 8. But I want to do that again, and so I wanted to come here to develop good practices for that, you know, next summer or next fall when I go out. And so what are some ways, just as individuals, that we can apply some of these things without that big budget of a corporation or, you know, things like that? Because, you know, making music is something that a lot of people do, you know what I mean? And touring is actually something that a lot of people do, whether you're on that huge scale or down here or somewhere in the middle. But the health that goes along with it, the physical health, the mental health, and the social health even, also applies to all of us. So what are some things you can say about that?
Well, as a starting point, what you just mentioned in terms of social health, I think checking in with each other, you know, is a great starting point, because everyone has needs, you know, and a lot of times your needs aren't getting met when you're in an unbalanced lifestyle. And so, you know, the people that you're working with, the people that you're traveling with, like, these are human beings. They're not just performers, you know. Yeah. And so to be mindful of that within yourself, but also the people around you. If you show that kind of compassion to other people and to yourself, you're going to fare a lot better, I think, in the long run. You're going to figure out solutions within your team.
Absolutely, and psychoeducation is free. You know, how you look after your body and you manage your stress responses doesn't have to be costing money. We have to finish. I'm really sorry. There's quite a lot we'd like to say, but come and chat to us at the end. Awesome. Thank you, everybody, for joining.